We're on.
I assume that's on.
Is that material?
Okay, at the meeting, we come to order. This is the House Finance Committee meeting. It is 1:45 in the afternoon on Thursday, March 13th. Today, we have before the committee House Bill 58, otherwise known as the Tort Reform Bill. And before we really get started, I want to let the members know we have the bill noticed for today and tomorrow. We can go today until just a few minutes before 4 o'clock, and then the room is needed by subcommittees to start closeout. I suspect that tomorrow will be much the same. The bill was not noticed for the weekend. I'm actually going to be gone over the weekend. And next week, we're running into a bit of a crunch for time. I think what I will do is notice continuation of work on HB 58 in the evenings, on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, if needed, just to see when we get done. Representative Martin?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the fiscal notice is so small comparatively. I've been thinking if we dwell just on the fiscal impact of it and not the other legal impact, we could pass it in about 5 minutes. I'll make a motion.
Well, then, Representative Martin, people will be able to suggest that we're flying blind, and I don't think that's what we want. I'm not sure exactly how the testimony is going to go today. We don't have a list that is all that long. And I'm not sure that the bill will actually go to next Monday or Tuesday evening. But just to make sure that we're covered before we actually get into the budget deliberation, which I believe what we will have is Monday, we will not have a meeting during the day. Representative Hanley asked that the day be kept for budget subcommittees to do all their closeout work on Monday. Mm-hmm. Tuesday, Wednesday would be supplemental. Thursday, we'll take action on bills that remain in the committee that we need to just do the final action on. Friday, we would start, would that be the presentation?
Yeah, we're going to adopt the subcommittee reports into the full committee, do a little bit of discussion on the front section so we know what's in there. I don't think there'll be very many changes, no. Any of that. And then
Saturday, we'll have a teleconference. So I was just telling the members that I think what we'll do is notice Monday night, Tuesday night, maybe on Wednesday night, work on tort reform if needed, just to be covered. And I was just wondering if how people's schedules are for that possibility.
I think Tuesday night's a problem for me, if you want to have a work session, because I've got closeouts and some of the budgets on Tuesday night.
I've got closeout on Tuesday night also.
Okay. Maybe what we'll do is notice that...
Might be able to do it in the afternoon, but I don't know if anybody's doing afternoon closeout.
Well, who does? Does anybody here have a closeout scheduled Monday afternoon?
Yeah, one on Monday. I'm not sure when it is.
Yeah, I'm just trying.
Yeah, one on Monday.
Monday afternoon.
Morning. Which budget is that, Representative?
Okay. Well, I'll have my staff check around. We may actually then be able to schedule the regular 1:30 to 4 meeting on Monday afternoon.
I wasn't really wanting to be comical there, but you know, as deep in thought as this is in judiciary and state affairs and all, I didn't think we had to wrangle everybody through the same thing when it's not our meeting for finance. We're worried about the fiscal impact and all these legal impacts and jurisdictions and stuff like that. I didn't think the committee time right now should be really brought up for 2 or 3 days. About the fiscal impact, amen, and you're going to have it on the floor for another 3 or 4 days.
Well, then, Representative Martin, then most of our meetings could be drastically curtailed then, because all we would look is, we'd flip past the bill, look at the fiscal notes. I don't think that would be a proof of operation.
You want a motion to pass the bill out of committee?
Yeah,
I'm
ready.
Sounds like Representative Martin.
Are we able
to
deal with the fiscal notes as we go?
Yeah, mostly.
Okay, we do have the prime sponsor of the bill here, Representative Porter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. As tempting as Representative Martin's position is, I'll endeavor to generally tell you about the bill. As a famous legislator from Nome has said, deja vu all over again. Seems like just yesterday I was sitting here explaining to this committee the majority of this bill. Because each of you has had the opportunity, I won't categorize that as a positive or negative, to hear this bill either both in finance and on the floor, but minimally at least on the floor. I'm going to try to explain anything that's new in the bill and gloss over the highlights of what you've already heard. And certainly if there are amendments or questions, please ask. But I recognize that this committee is pretty familiar with this subject. Consequently, we have approached it in the executive summary fashion, if you will. To that end, we only have six or seven people that will be presenting testimony for this bill. In your packets, and I know you, like the rest of us, have a wealth of things to read, but I would commend to you the packet of information that has 20-some letters from organizations representing a whole lot of folks who are in support of this bill. They range from Alaska's bigger industries to small business to individual professionals. Rather than take up your time having all of these folks testify, we're only having five, which I think will be representative of the cross-section of support that this bill has. The bill itself mainly is comprised of, I guess, three general categories. One, it is, in essence, the bill that passed the floor of the House last year. It also incorporates several sections, about 8 or 9 or 10 sections of the bill that incorporate things that the governor's task force developed during the summer at the task force meetings on tort reform. And there are, other than that, and those, some of those will be familiar to you because they are things that were discussed in the other bill. There are only really two other sections that are new, and I'll, to the extent that I can, and have other witnesses explain what those two are in detail so that you'll have a full understanding of that. To give you the overview, I guess, recalling 158, ironically, this bill is 58. One of the more salient features is that it does cap damages. Again, I guess the best thing to do when you start discussing this bill is to tell you what it doesn't do rather than what it does. What it doesn't do is have anything to do with limiting or affecting workers' comp cases. On-the-job injuries are covered under workers' comp, Title 23. You will notice nothing in this bill affects Title 23. So to the extent that workers' comp claims are offered and approved, this bill doesn't touch that, doesn't limit the amount of awards in a workers' comp on-the-job injury type case, doesn't have any effect on it. There is a tie-in to a workers' comp lien into a third-party case, which I'll explain as we get to it, but that doesn't affect the plaintiff's award in a workers' comp case. There are three kinds of damages that you can seek when you are injured by someone else's negligence: economic, non-economic, and punitive. Economic damages are those damages that are articulatable, they're objective, they can be defined and determined, and they are any cost that has accrued to you as a result of this injury or this death or this property damage. You were in a car that was hit negligently by someone else and you were injured, it would be the economic damage area that you would claim to get your car replaced or fixed, that you would claim to get your body fixed, your medical expenses. You would claim if you missed work because of this accident, and if in the future you were going to have additional medical expenses or additional loss of wages. All of those kinds of things are economic damages. This bill doesn't limit those kinds of things at all. It limits the other two. It puts an upper cap on the other two. Non-economic damages are those damages that subjectively go to compensate people for pain and suffering, loss of consortium, those kinds of non-definable but obviously real concerns that people have. Or feelings that people have. Our bill caps those at $300,000 per claim or $500,000 per claim in more serious cases. Punitive damages are the damages that our Supreme Court has said are not meant for compensation. They are meant to punish a defendant whose behavior or action, whether it was an omission or commission, was so outrageous, was malicious, that punishment was called for as opposed to just trying to compensate someone for their loss. Currently, that's unlimited. We are saying that that should be limited, and it should be limited to $300,000 or three times compensatory, as we had in the bill last year. This year, taking a lead, I guess, from the task force, we have made an exception to that. And in very serious profit motive Ford Pinto types of cases, we've expanded that to $600,000 or four times compensatory, whichever is greater. So there's never ceases to be the ability to make some adjustments in this type of legislation, so we have already done that. As before, the bill includes a change in the court decision that resulted in hospitals being found liable for negligence of emergency room doctors. We've prescribed that, as we did last year, that because of their independence and inability of the hospital to really supervise or instruct or control their medical practices, that assuming that they advertise in the paper, take due diligence in certifying these doctors into their own hospitals, make sure that they are capable and trained and have the basic qualifications to perform this work, that they notice also in the emergency room, but they don't have to be held responsible for that doctor's negligence in that they don't control or supervise their activities. But they do, again, an accommodation that we've made, they do have to require now that those doctors carry liability insurance up to, or at minimally, $500,000, for instance. The apportionment of fault is the same. Basically, the bill allows that the initiative of 1988 is, by statute now, if this bill passes, back in effect. That statute or that initiative sought to eliminate joint and several liability, which means basically that a defendant should be held responsible for the percentage of fault that the jury finds he or she or they are responsible for, and not more. That's the simplest way to state it, and that's what basically this bill then provides. The collateral benefit is in the bill. The collateral benefit is basically that other kinds of compensation or benefits that a plaintiff has received to compensate him for the claims that he's making against a defendant or other defendants, that information gets to be provided to the jury, as opposed to the way it is now. It's not afforded to the jury and only given to the court afterwards so that the judgment can be reduced by that amount. What the bill proposes is that the jury should be entitled to know those things so that they can make in their judgment, in their decision on the judgment, have that full information, that full picture of what it is that's in front of them, make the appropriate judgment taking those collateral benefits into account. The offer of judgment is in the bill. We had an offer of judgment provision in the previous bill. This one is, I guess, a little enhanced, and it's enhanced by virtue of taking some of the procedure suggested for this area from the task force. An offer of judgment, of course, is an offer made by one side or the other to settle the case as their discussions go along prior to trial. The sooner an offer of judgment is made and can be accepted and the settlement established, the less expensive to both sides this litigation is going to be. So we have a provision, again, based on the procedure suggested by the task force, that an offer of judgment made very early in the proceedings, in this case about 30 days after the time for discovery has occurred so that both sides can evaluate their case, If you make an offer of judgment within 30 days of that time, and it is rejected, and then you end up not settling and going to trial, and then the judgment is rendered, and it's found that that judgment is virtually the same within 5%, virtually the same as the offer that you refused, you have obviously wasted a lot of people's time and money, and as a penalty, you have to pay the other side's, the person who made that offer, their full actual attorney fees and costs from the time that offer was made till the judgment was rendered. We're told that will get some folks' attention, that more appropriate offers will be made as a result of that, more appropriate analysis of these offers will be made, and a lot more will be accepted, and a lot of money and time and expense will be saved. Those are the main points of the bill that you've heard about before. Those sections that were adopted in the task force, I'll try to go through, there's about eight of them, and I'll try to hit the highlights of those. I don't think that they're that controversial they're not that complex. We have included in the description of a tort that an intentional act is also to be considered as a tort. Basically, a tort's defined as negligence or gross negligence on the part of someone else, where no one has, to my knowledge, found, but there has been litigation by some defendants saying, well, it doesn't say that this covers an intentional act, so it probably didn't mean to cover an intentional act, and so since the act that my client performed, he meant to do, it wasn't, you know, if you're suing somebody for damages resulting in getting hit in the nose, a defense would be, I don't think anybody would buy it in their right mind, but a defense would be, I'm sorry, this isn't a tort, that was an assault. He meant to hit you in the nose. Well, anybody I can talk to says no, tort law is supposed to include that, but it was a suggestion by some folks just to save that point of litigation to include the word intentional in this description, so we have.
Representative Porter, that I actually had separate legislation on that last year that the House voted on. I think it went across either unanimously or with overwhelming support and got caught up on the Senate side. And the example that was used was the mail bombing case in Anchorage. Yeah. There was a suit, and they alleged that, well, no, we meant to injure people, so therefore you can't bring the tort against us. The courts have ruled against that, but defendants keep bringing it up, yeah. And we have to expend money time and time again. So that was something that the House took action on last year.
The current law has a fixed interest rate for prejudgment interest. Prejudgment interest is that amount of money that is paid by a defendant to the plaintiff for, in effect, not paying him immediately upon the occurrence of the injury or damage, and waiting until the months and months have gone by till the judgment's rendered after the trial or the settlement is made. That had been at a fixed rate of 10.5, and the task force recommended, as I think we had in the bill last year, that should be a floating rate more close to the actual value of money than just a fixed rate of 10.5.
Representative Porter, the mm-hmm. first one, the intentional acts, was section 19. Do you have section numbers there as you go through these that you could just point out to the members?
I haven't got them specifically listed in my little sheet here, but
the floating interest.
That's true. Section 19 is the intentional torts.
Floating is 23.
Interest is 23. The next one I'm going to talk about is the medical advisory panels, and that's section 28, 29, 30, and 31. This, again, is right out of the task force reports. It's just making expert advisory panels available in state health care cases. It, for some reason, wasn't available to cases where the doctors were public employees rather than or on public contract. it changes some of the questions that the medical panel asks, as was requested by persons who perform these services. Some of the questions are in statute for some reason, and I guess so that they'll be consistently asked, but they didn't. One of the next one is they didn't include the ability to consider omissions rather than commissions, and of course that's part of the standards that they're looking at. And they additionally suggested, and we've incorporated the language that would allow discovery to proceed on the case, even though the advisory panel had not yet rendered their decision to the court. An advisory medical panel is a group of three doctors appointed in medical malpractice cases to look preliminarily at the case and then advise the court on their opinion of whether there's merit to this accusation or claim or not. The fleeing felon section
Thirty-seven, I believe.
Thank you. Yes. As it was last year and is now incorporated in the task force report, we've added the fleeing felon as opposed to just the felon who's been convicted, who cannot then sue for and asking for an award from any damages he received while he was actually committing or fleeing from the felony. Textbook case is the burglar who fell through the skylight of the business he was burglarizing and collected because he was injured. we're adding fleeing to this because some cases in Anchorage, at least two, were people, felons, fleeing from a robbery that ran into a tree and killed themselves. Subsequently, of course, could not be convicted of the crime, but their estate sued the city for chasing them. And we think that's patently ridiculous. You have to establish in court, if there is a suit, by clear and convincing evidence, which is the highest civil standard that there is, that this actually was the result of a felony. But it eliminates the requirement, especially in those cases where you can't have that requirement, conviction. That was established and recommended by the task force. They discussed, didn't get a chance really to act on, but we have subsequently looked at it close enough that I think it's appropriate and put it in, that in addition to that, we're going to add those folks who were involved in DWI, that as a result of their DWI had an accident and then they want to sue somebody. We don't think that's appropriate either. So those folks who were involved in driving while under the influence fall in the same category as a felon. I guess that's the better way to say it is that's the one misdemeanor that we're adding to the list of people involved in felonies. The task force recommended, and we certainly endorse the notion that we should provide, the insurance companies should provide to the Division of Insurance an adequate amount of information so that they can begin to analyze the effect of tort reforms or tort laws in general on insurance rates. And to the extent that we can do that, we're putting a section in the bill that requires that reporting by insurance companies. Additionally,
what section was that?
Section
39?
Yeah,
39.
That's right.
39.
Mm-hmm. What version are we on?
Section.
Or the judiciary version?
I've got judiciary K.
But I think. Right. All of your comments are on the judiciary version of the bill?
Yes. Yes.
There's a sectional analysis here.
We just completed a new sectional that I hope you have. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
The next is section 46, settlement information. One of the realities that we knew of in the last 3 or 4 years when we were discussing the bill that was highlighted during the task force consideration was that 95% of the tort cases don't ever get to trial. They're settled prior to trial. Anecdotally, we have heard a lot of testimony, and you'll hear some more, about the fact that settlements in the cases where they're asking for non-economic and punitive damages quite often result, the result of the settlement is higher than most folks thought it should have been because of the concern about the unlimited exposure caused by the unlimited liability in non-economic and punitive damages. We can hear it anecdotally. We can't establish it empirically because 99% of those settlements are sealed verdicts that you cannot, both parties have agreed to keep it confidential, so we can't get in there and look, see what the claim was, what the settlement was, what the facts were, and see if there's a correlation. Consequently, we're asking the court to send to the Judicial Council the relevant facts minus the names of the parties in these cases of settlement so that they can begin to amass this information and try to get some empirical data on this phenomenon and hypothesis that most people have that this is what's happening. That's in there also. Additionally, in section 35, that's not where I'm at.
Representative Porter, what section was that on the...
I'm looking for a section that we've added $10,000 as opposed to $1,000.
48.
Yes.
Me too.
Okay, thank you very much. As it was last year, this was kind of ironic. The task force went at this problem for a few months, made a big circle, and came right back to where 158 was 2 years ago. We did, and they have suggested, and it's back in this bill, we increased the capability of the court to fine for frivolous allegations from $1,000 to $10,000. In addition to that, we have taken a provision out of a, quite frankly, lifted it out of a bill that Representative Mulder has, that provides that if a jury finds that a party has made a material misrepresentation, which is a euphemism for a lie, about a claim, that that person loses or wins, depending on which side he was on, that particular claim. So it's going to, I think, have an additional encouragement to be forthright in your claims, not embellish them, and to the extent that there are some suits that fall into that category, this is another measure, I think, that will assist the reduction of frivolous lawsuits. Finally, then, looking at things that are in the bill that were from the task force, this is an amendment to something that was in the task force. One of the more important aspects of tort reform is trying to keep cases from getting on into the system through the whole process that drives up costs, the motions and interrogatories and discovery activity and depositions cost a lot of money, and that's what sometimes brings the cost of litigation higher than what the claim is in the first place. Anything that can serve the function of getting these things settled at the front end rather than at the tail end is meritorious from a general standpoint of tort reform. To that effort, then, one of the things to consider are alternatives to that process, and that has been nicely defined as alternative dispute resolution processes. Mediation, arbitration, early neutral evaluation are programs that are out there that work towards this this end. We have asked the Judicial Council in our bill to go out and gather types of programs that are available. Specifically, there's one in Seattle on mediation that has shown it purports to have an 80% success rate, which sounds pretty good. That stuff's out there, so it's not going to take a long time to gather. It will take some time, a matter of months, to analyze it to the application of the types of cases that we have in our court system and the applicability then to those types of cases of these other programs. They're going to do that, and we're asking them to come back by this time next year with a report on that so that we can look at their work and sponsor legislation, whoever would like to, that will add this ingredient to the whole package of tort reform. The task force wanted to do a demonstration program on arbitration in this third judicial district, and there were two problems with that. One, we don't know that we haven't really taken a good enough look to see if that is the best program to use as a pilot program. It might be a mediation program that we needed to use, or maybe an early neutral evaluation, I don't know. And that it had one heck of a fiscal note, and I didn't want to present that to you guys, quite frankly. So until we can find out that this really is going to be applicable, and then can analyze also how much we think we can save because of that applicability, I'm not ready to walk in here and say, let's spend $1 million and take a shot. Anyway, that is the bulk of the things that are in the bill from the task force. There are, as I said, two other things that are in the bill that are new. And the first one has to do with the possible liability of electrical utilities at Section 35. Case law, Prosser on torts, which is kind of the Bible of issues that hasn't otherwise been decided, or generally case law follows what Prosser says, say that electrical service is not a product, it is a service, and consequently should not be held to the standard of strict liability. Products are held to strict liability. That is to say, if you're driving down a street in your car and it breaks and something happens, the manufacturer of the car is strictly liable for what happened because it's a product that he provided to you. As opposed to that, the general thinking is that electrical service is a service, not that, and of course if it's negligently done, susceptible to a tort claim just like anything else, but not just because something happened are they liable. We're providing that in statute because there is a concern that that might happen, kind of like the independent or intentional act as opposed to a negligent act. I don't think it would, but it doesn't hurt anything to put it in. It will give our electrical utilities and ERECA some degree of comfort to know that they don't have to go try to defend that kind of a case. And there is one case in Alaska now filed that's making that suggestion, making that as a claim. It's a case somewhere in the interior that a person jury-rigged himself an electrical line from a friend's house, took the service into his friend's house, over into his house, and his house burned. Well, nobody with a license did that. He did it himself, but he's claiming strict liability since it was electricity that did it. I don't think this guy's going to win, but it's being made, and they're having to defend it. So to the extent that that's going to cost people some money, and that cost is going to be reflected in those people's rates, I think it's a good idea to get that out of the law, or get it into the law so that we don't have those kinds of suits. The other new area has to do with independent counsel as required by case law in cases where insurance companies cover the liability of a defendant but don't cover all of the claims that are made against him. And I'm quickly looking. Okay, it's section 40, 41, and 42. Let's say, if you're covered by insurance and for a liability insurance policy and you're sued, the kinds of claims that are made against you, kind of as from an insurance company's point of view, fall into three categories. One is a claim that they clearly have coverage for and they're obligated to pay and defend you on. Second one is the area where they may or may not cover you and have this obligation. That is the kind of situation where they take what's called a reservation of rights, and they'll defend you, but reserve the right if the facts develop, and this is the only way that they can determine whether they do or don't have responsibility. If the facts develop that they do, then they do, and that's what they'll cover if there is a judgment. The third category is categories that they clearly deny coverage on. There's no way, shape, or form that this policy covers that particular thing, so they're out of it. What has happened is that the best case, I guess, of example of the reservation of rights, most insurance policies will not cover you if you negligent, if you injured someone or someone's property and that your action was intentional. If you hit somebody in the nose, probably your homeowner's policy is not going to cover you because that's an intentional act that you did and it only covers accidents. But you're claiming that you didn't intend to hit him in the nose, that you just stumbled and your hand came across his jaw, or, you know, however you want to do it. I'm making a ridiculous example, but for the sake of example. Until the court or the jury decides themselves whether this was an intentional act or an accidental act, they don't know whether they cover you or not. Consequently, they have this reservation of rights, and they'll pay for it and defend you and all, but if it turns out that the jury says he meant to do this, they're not going to pay the judgment, and they're probably going to try to get a little of their defense costs back, but they rarely do. What has happened as those kinds of cases have appeared before the court, the case law has developed that there is a conflict of interest between the insurance company and their own client, their own insured, on those reservation of rights cases because of the possibility that they wouldn't have to have liability. So the courts have indicated, have required that the defendant, the insured individual, gets to have independent counsel paid for by the insurance company. But this independent counsel, this independent attorney, does not work for the insurance company because of that conflict. He only works for the insured. Well, that turned out to be a real catbird position for those who find themselves as independent counsels because they work for somebody who doesn't care how much money they run up, and the bill's paid by somebody who has no control over how much they run up. And there's been a couple of cases where these folks have run up $800,000, $900,000. And it was a nice idea, but unfortunately, where there's a will, there's a way. And if there's an opportunity for abuse, there will be. And so some parameters have to be put on. To that extent, then, they have also, because of a concern of they don't know what the law really says, trying to combine statutory law and case law, what insurance companies have found themselves being required to do is not only to cover the first and second kinds of complaints, but the third kind also, where they actually deny coverage. But rather than be in a position where they might be susceptible to a bad faith suit, which has sanctions, treble damages, they have been furnishing independent counsel for those claims too. It's come to a point where that the cost of that is now affecting rates and all that stuff. So again, trying to make this the law make sense and to pay what you're owed and to not get paid what you're not owed and all that kind of stuff, these three sections basically provide that, yes, an insurance company has to provide independent counsel for Category 1 and Category 2, or or Category 2 type claims, the reservation of right type claims, just as they are required to. They do not have to provide counsel for the third type of claim, where they deny coverage. And believe me, they're not going to deny coverage unless they're absolutely sure, because if they have denied coverage and they're found to be wrong, the sanctions for that, which is the bad faith suit, is severe. It also provides, since they're paying the bill, that they can negotiate a settlement with the plaintiff on these type 1 and type 2 claims. Basically, that's what these three provisions provide. There is one other section I forgot to mention that is new, Section 42.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask a question?
Kelly?
Mm-hmm. I didn't quite understand the upshot of Section 41, 42,
sure.
43 was that the insurance companies are required to provide independent counsel, but they are also required, or they have the option to, what was it?
Settle with the plaintiff on those claims, independent of their insured.
Gotcha.
Since they're paying the bills, yeah. This is a very small provision that gets into an area that's a little bit complicated, but I'll try to make it real quick, and this is the last one. Currently, in a case where there is a third-party defendant in a workers' comp case, that is to say, the workers' comp, there was an on-the-job injury, a worker was injured, and under workers' comp, the employer is 100% at fault for the actual damages and costs, the economic damages to that worker. There are no non-economic and punitive in workers' comp, which might make us wonder why we have it in others. But anyway, once that case is settled, the employee, if he thinks that that injury might have been in some way caused by someone else in addition to his employer, he can sue them. The case that is reflected in the statutes quite often is a Lake case, where I think it was an electrical company, the employee was working in a cherry picker, one of those machines that puts a little cage up in the air and you work on lines and stuff. And that employee was injured, and after the workers' comp case was settled, he sued the manufacturer of the cherry picker. Current law would provide that if that were the case, and let's say he received $50,000 in his workers' comp case, he went over in this third-party case against the cherry picker manufacturer and convinced him that this guy was really bad and not. Currently, the cherry picker would not be able to say, but wait a minute, the employer is partially at fault here. He would only be able to say, either I am absolutely not at fault in any degree, and the employer is totally at fault, and if they found that, fine, then he's off the hook. But the employer doesn't get to, in any event, the employer doesn't get to get brought into this suit, considering apportionment of fault arguments. This is an empty chair case that exists now and always will because of the workers' comp laws. That's the only way that the cherry picker manufacturer can get out of that one. Otherwise, he has to try to defend himself and not let the jury apportion any fault to the employer. And he's stuck with whatever they come up with, unless he wants to try to bring somebody else in. Let's say in that case that he gets $100,000, a judgment of $100,000 over here with the cherry picker guy. Current law says that the employer can run over here and attach that judgment to the full amount of what he had to pay, so he can take $50,000 out of that $100,000 award, leaving the plaintiff in that case with a total of $100,000, the $50 he got in workers' comp, and the remaining $50 that he got out of his judgment. that's okay if it happens to work out in that nice proportion, but what if really the cherry picker person was only 1% at fault, or was 99% at fault? What we're providing is that the workers' comp lien can come over, and first under the other provisions, we're saying that the workers' comp situation can be discussed at a trial, and that the jury should apportion whatever percentage of fault they think exists to the employer. Then when the employer comes back over to get compensated for what he had to pay in the workers' comp area, he can only get compensated to the extent that the jury determined that he was or wasn't at fault. So if they say that he was, in that case, if they say he was 50% at fault, he can come over and get his $50,000. But if they say he was 60% at fault, he can't get that amount. He can only get the difference. If they say that he was 99% at fault, he can come only get 1% of that $100,000 worry. So in that case, really, the plaintiff, I think, is in a better position to receive more, but it's going to cut down litigation of him knowing what's there and just being a very straightforward, this is what I get, this is what I not get. But a plaintiff won't get zapped and getting his whole award over here taken away. That's a very long explanation of something that isn't that big a deal, but that's what it is. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I'd now love to jump right into the testimony with your permission, unless there's something that, question of something you might not understand.
Do the committee members have questions for Representative Porter?
Not. Thank you very much.
Representative Porter, we do have a number of people on teleconference. First, I would like to go to Cordova for Mr. Ross Mullins and then Jack Hopkins. Mr. Mullins, are you there?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to speak here today. I am speaking for myself and for Sherry Shaw, who is the UFA representative for the Reform Committee, and we have faxed down a proposed amendment that UFA has developed, which is pretty much the language of the governor's policy council this summer on punitive damages. We do feel that this punitive damages that is proposed in Bill 58 is extremely detrimental to maintaining a safe and prudent posture when it comes to oil transportation safety measures. We strongly believe that these so-called deterrent caps are not sufficient to get the attention of the major players. Representative Porter alluded in his earlier remarks to you folks there. He called it certain industry players. Well, let's come out and be clear about what we're talking about here. We're talking about the oil industry. I don't see any other certain industry players that are going to have huge benefits from this type of thing. So, you know, occasionally the conduct of a defendant is so repugnant that a jury assesses punitive damages, and under existing law, the conduct must be outrageous. It must be proven by clear and convincing evidence. Punitive damages are rarely awarded. When the juries speak, corporate America listens. That's why effectively designed cribs no longer strangle infants. Trucks have backup alarms. Once harmful medical devices that have been redesigned. Auto fuel systems have been strengthened. Cancer-causing asbestos no longer poisons homes, schools, and workplaces, and farm machinery has safety guards. Punitive damages cases are very uncommon. A comprehensive study of punitive damages in products liability cases found only 355 punitive damages awards between 1965 and 1990. One quarter of those were asbestos cases. 80% of the time, the manufacturer enacted a safety measure after the verdict. In the much maligned McDonald's coffee spill case, two things happened. The judge lowered the punitive damage award to $450,000, and McDonald's finally turned down the temperature of its coffee, something that 750 prior accidents and complaints had not been able to accomplish. This bill lets criminals off the hook. Now a driver who is high on drugs and kills meets the outrageous test due to his reckless indifference to safety. This bill would require proof of conscious acts by a drunk driver. Who will claim he did not know what he was doing? very likely not conscious. The bill insults jury intelligence by capping the punitive award of the greater of $300,000 or three times compensatory. Some corporations profit from systematic small thefts over many thousands of transactions. Limiting punitive damages to an arbitrary level undercuts their deterrent value, since reckless or malicious defendants might find it more cost-effective to continue their bad behavior. This is precisely the decision making employed by Ford Motor Company in regard to its Pinto automobile. The company determined that it would be cheaper to sell the defectively designed car and risk paying damage awards to injured consumers than it would be to make the car significantly safer at a cost of $11 per car. The conservative United States Supreme Court recently upheld a substantial punitive award in the millions where the compensatory damages were $19,000, but heavy deterrence was needed. Few other states limit punitive damages. Why should Alaska juries faced with overwhelming evidence of outrageous conduct be handcuffed? So I would urge you gentlemen to give serious thought to looking at this bill with some degree of skepticism. These other industry players that are referred to, I think we all know who they are, and these levels of punitive damages are not going to get their attention. Prior to 1989, we saw the ability and the safety measures that were designed to provide protection for commercial fishermen and other users of the water resources in coastal Alaska were rapidly eroded as carelessness and negligence became more at work. Cost-cutting became more and more of the order of the day. Since this oil spill in 89 and since the trial, there's been a major effort on the part of the industry to address what was apparently a problem to them prior to this, because these issues were never addressed prior to the spill. I would almost assure you that if we put these caps in place and not make exemptions for large industry to not be affected by these if they are voted in, that we will end up back in the same situation we were prior to 1989 in coastal Alaska, and tens of thousands of commercial fishermen and others will end up being the ones that pay the price. Now I ask you, are those your constituents? Do these people vote? I wish you'd give that serious thought before you act on a bill of this nature. If there is anything to be learned from this, I think we should look at what happened with the governor's council this past summer, where they arrived at consensus on many issues that this bill mandates be dealt with in a different fashion. The governor's proposals would be much more satisfactory to most people living in coastal Alaska. At least in that regard, it addresses the magnitude of wrong and the size of the wrongdoer, and it doesn't put some arbitrary cap on that. It causes over time the erosion of the value of those dollars by the ongoing grinding in a small inflation that is always existent. 15 years from now, $300,000 cap might be worth $100,000, if that. So I thank you very much for your time, and I hope you'll give serious thought to rejecting this House Bill 58.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for the witness? If not, we'll take Mr. Jack Hopkins, and then we'll go to Dr. David McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jack Hopkins, and I am an old and lifelong Alaskan. I am opposed to House Bill 58 because it looks to me like the only groups of it here that will benefit from this bill are the insurance companies and the other big businesses. You know, I've never seen a case where, you know, attorneys were able to get around whatever kind of rules or laws that the people make down there. So it looks like you're just creating another kind of a monster that people are going to be able to get around anyway. And the only people that seem to be left unprotected are basically just that, the small people. So I agree with Ross, and if you really are in earnest of helping out small businesses, there are a heck of a lot of different ways to help them out by excluding them from some other rules that you have and other laws or tax exemptions or other things like that, but not handcuffing them by taking away their basic rights. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? If not, we'll go to Dr. McGuire in Anchorage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the opportunity to testify on HB58. I've forwarded some written documentation, which I hope you've received, and they would include two sheets relative to the case of one Mr. Justice, and also some information from the American Academy of Actuaries. In 1976, malpractice insurance, as it's called, became unavailable for many people, many doctors in the state of Alaska. As a result of that, the legislature formed an organization called MICA, Medical Indemnity Corporation of Alaska. That was designed to provide doctors with malpractice insurance because not only had the cost of malpractice insurance become unimaginable, but it was simply unavailable. That same organization, it's interesting the gentlemen were testifying from Cordova, that same organization insured the doctors in Cordova, but because of a thing known as claims made policy, the insurance rates kept going up with the state, quasi-state organization called MICA, to the extent that after the third year, the doctors in Cordova were no longer able to afford the rate, and therefore it had to quit buying insurance and could not afford the tail coverage either. And as a result, the MICA kept all the money that the doctors had paid, and the doctors in Cordova, and therefore their patients, were uninsured for all of those years. So that's another practical effect of the absence of tort reform. If you'll notice on the first page a written summary of this case, fundamentally, the individual's name was Justice. He was involved in a bar fight. He had a head injury, went to what was then Regional Hospital, Community Hospital, and was x-rayed and no abnormalities were found. He came back 24 hours later complaining of a headache, and again, no abnormalities were found. He went to California, and after three admissions in California, he was admitted the third time with a stroke and was discovered to have a Barry aneurysm, which is a congenital malformation. He sued in California, and the doctors elected to settle there. And on the second page, you'll see the results of that settlement negotiation in California. He then returned to Alaska and sued in Alaska. He initially sued the doctors and the hospital, but then subsequently dropped the doctors. And this was before the initiative of 1988 with joint several, and therefore the hospital was entirely liable under joint several. And you'll see on the right-hand side the numbers that were involved in there in the jury verdict in Alaska. So here we have a case in which an individual alleged the same injury, suffered the same damage, had the same economic and non-economic consequences, but the difference in the cost to the system is well illustrated by comparing the numbers on the left-hand column with those on the right-hand column. And even if you leave out the insurance defense fees, which we don't know for California, you can see that the cost on the left was $578,958, and on the right, in the state of Alaska, for the same individual, same injury, etc., it was $1,859,000. And it's worth pointing out how we get to that verdict. So you see, at the top, the total jury verdict. Well, what has happened there is that the $32,000 in the left-hand column has been multiplied by 42 years and paid in a lump sum. And on top of that, economic damages. Then the 10% comparative negligence reduced. But notice also that the judge, using his discretion in this case, reduced the $578,000 on the left to $210,000, and subtracted that as the present value. That is inappropriate in our opinion, and that's what needs definition as to what should be offset in the collateral benefits, and that's why collateral benefits are so important. If you note the column of prejudgment interest, there was $683,534 of prejudgment interest, but what's interesting is that arose from May 30th of 82 to March 16th of 88, only 6 years. But the prejudgment interest was calculated on the entire lifetime earnings of this individual, so money that he had not even earned was added into that. So the net effect of this case, regardless of the merits of the case, regardless of whether this was a congenital malformation, regardless of any other activities, the point is that there are two systems which endeavored to compensate this individual. The one in California with its micro-tort reform, Act of 1975, and the one in Alaska in which there was no substantial tort reform. And it's quite easy to see what the difference in cost is, and when you have that kind of differences in cost, it's quite easy to see why there would be a difference in the premiums ultimately. So Finally, I would recommend to you the paper called A Surgical Fix for Medical Malpractice. This was written by the American Academy of Actuaries, provided to us by Jim Jordan from the Alaska State Medical Association. This is not a study that was commissioned by the doctors. It's a study that was done by the actuaries. And without boring you with the details, what it says, in essence, is that based on the studies of tort reform done in the individual states, such as California, Ohio, New York, etc., it's fairly clear that unless a comprehensive package of tort reforms is enacted, no single tort reform issue is going to be effective. Rather like having a leaky bucket with a dozen holes in it and trying to plug one hole. So I would urge you to consider that HB 58 in its entirety is what is required to rectify this otherwise unhappy situation with the tort system. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Dr. McGuire? If not, we will next go to Anchorage, and I have Dick Cotnot.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate your allowing me to testify on this. According to the board here, we have 3 minutes to testify. I have submitted written testimony to you with some other information, so what I'll try to do is just summarize my thoughts on this bill. You might wonder why we're talking again this year about civil justice reform. To put it in perspective, with Social Security, 99 cents out of every dollar that's collected goes back to recipients. With health insurance, 85% of every dollar that's collected goes to the beneficiaries. Workers' comp, 70 cents of every dollar goes to the beneficiaries. Under the civil justice system, less than 50 cents goes back to the beneficiaries. And I'd like to give you an illustration of how that might happen. And this is in a published article. It had to do with a class action suit over dental adhesives, which was settled for $1 million. The original plaintiff got $25,000. Another 650 plaintiffs ended up with $7 each, and the remaining $2,800 plaintiffs received discount coupons for dental products. The winning attorneys took home $954,000. $900, or just over 95% of the total claim. So that illustrates some of the problems we have. The article, or the letter I sent you, dealt with two issues that are of importance to the Associated General Contracts, of which contractors, of which I'm the legislative committee chairman. Statute of repose and punitive damages, and I think I set forth our position there fairly clearly, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those. You can either call me or get a message to me somehow, and I'll clarify those. But I'd like to also address the issue on the governor's task force. The bill before you contains 13 provisions that were included of the 15 recommendations from the governor's task force. And that doesn't mean they were included word for word, but of those recommendations, 13 of the 15 were included. The two that were left out had to do with changes in the judicial system, which were passed on to the court system, and it's up to them to determine whether or not they want to incorporate those recommendations. But on that committee, there were 20 members. Almost 40% of those members were attorneys. None of the people who have been active in the civil justice reform fight for the last 4 to 10 years sat on that board. This includes the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce, NFIB, the construction industry, the airline industry, truckers, the miners, the insurance industry, the tourist, or the restaurant and tavern industry. So you can see that we believe this bill, 58, is a much better bill than the governor's bill because it's more expansive and includes the concerns of these other organizations. We would recommend that you give serious thought to this and that you pass it out to committee at the earliest possible time. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Were there questions from the committee members? If not, the next person is Mike Schneider.
May it please the chair and members of the committee, my name is Mike Schneider. I'm an attorney in Anchorage. I will stay within the allotted time limits. Allow me to begin by saying that if the governor's task force efforts did anything, force answers were really answers in search of a question. The task force process criticized a moment ago, in fact, reflected huge efforts by members of the business community, attorneys represent both sides of the fence, and if you really look at what the task force found that there is a public perception that the wheels are off the civil justice cart. And aside from that myth and that confusion, little else is wrong. I would like to endorse the good sense that apparently prevails in Cordova and question why the salt air in that area doesn't have the same intellectually cleansing effect farther south along the coastline. There are just so many provisions of this bill that do a disservice to your constituents that I am surprised it is getting such rapid treatment. I'm just going to talk about a couple of them. However, you could throw darts at this thing and find just some egregious approaches to what's supposed to be legitimate public policy. If you look at Section 15, the collateral benefits section, and I'd ask you to look at 15 in conjunction with 19, that includes intentional wrongdoers, not those people that are just reckless and hurt your constituents, but folks that are out to hurt them. If I see Representative Porter on the street and I'm aggravated about his long history of criticizing a pretty good system, I decide to run him down. Under Section 19, I'm given the benefit of these various legal reforms, one of which is the collateral benefits treatment in Section 15. So if my victim has paid for his own insurance coverage, his own disability coverage, the claim against me, the intentional actor, is reduced by the victim's payments over time and really by the victim's insurance company's payments to the situation. It is absurd. The fleeing felon provision. I mean, as if Alaskan jurors are given money every day to fleeing felons. What a bunch of smoke. I'll quit now, but this is a slap in the face to your constituents that serve on juries. They don't do bizarre things. The wheels are off the cart. And I ask you to look at this bill carefully. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And for those in Anchorage and Mr. Schneider, I wasn't sure how many people to anticipate today, so I did ask that the three-minute limit be placed on the testimony. The list is not as long as I had anticipated. I don't want to encourage people to go on, but you know, if you can wrap up your thoughts in 4 or 5 minutes or whatever, I don't want to cut people off if they have a point that they want to make. But we do want to make sure that everybody has an opportunity today.
Many people are today more capable than I am to talk on this issue. There's a lot of different points to hit. I'll get out of your way, and I appreciate your indulgence. Unless you have questions, I'll defer to the next person on the list.
Were there questions for the witness? Okay, if not, we'll take Daryl Nelson, and then Frank Dillon, and then we'll go to Kenai for a couple of people after Mr. Nelson and Mr. Dillon.
Okay, like the previous speaker has stated, this, in my opinion, is a slap in the face for your constituents, because if you have periodic payments, that person that is disabled and disabled for the rest of their life, they will lose their health care benefits. A few other things. I have a problem with the statute of repose, because the 8-year limit is terrible on a child that is born and has a disability, because the majority of the parents out there that have children, they don't know the law, and therefore are they expected to know what it is they have to deal with? They're not supposed to know. Am I supposed to run out to find out my legal rights because something's wrong. The majority of the young parents, newly parents out there, don't think about these things. They think about having a perfect child. They don't think about, well, is it doctors at fault? That's the report. It's terrible. You need to get rid of it. Actually, not even in action, but make sure, if this bill passes, it will be enacted and it's going to hurt your constituents. There's so many things wrong with this thing that I'm afraid that if people in general find out about this, you may not be elected next time. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we'll take Mr. Frank Dillon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Frank Dillon. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Trucking Association, which is a 38-year-old trade association representing about 300 companies, most of which are small businesses, and employing approximately 20,000 people in the state of Alaska. Members of Alaska Trucking Association strongly urge you to support HB 58. We believe that America is drowning in a sea of judicial abuse. It seems apparent to anyone outside the legal system, the legal thinking and common sense of part of company. HB 58 is a small but much needed step towards a complete reconstruction of our legal system. We would urge you not to succumb to the arguments that will surely attempt to kill the bill or at least amend it into ineffectiveness. Just to give you some very quickly an example of how this the process of concern over tort and civil liability has crept into every phase of business thinking. We were discussing this morning in my office traffic moving up and down the Dalton Highway, and we recognize that the traffic is going to be increasing on that highway as the road is improved and word gets out to more and more people that it is open to the public. For the past 15 years, we've used a fairly sophisticated system of communication between the trucks in order to make sure that on corners and on hills and where we have line of sight problems, that the traffic knows what's on the road, both southbound and northbound. It's a result of that effort that's actually kept, I think, the accidents substantially down on the Dalton Highway. This morning, as we were thinking about the upcoming hauling season and the upcoming tourist season, we talked about whether or not it would be prudent for us to expand that to where we tried to communicate with motorists on the road. And immediately we were faced with that old conundrum, well, if we tell them and they don't hear us right, then we've taken the responsibility for their safety. However, on the other hand, as a good citizen who's using the road, if we don't try to tell them we're coming, and they happen to be parked in the middle of the road and we hit them, we haven't done them or ourselves any good. Now, it seems common sense would dictate here that if you're doing the best job you can to try to help other people out and make sure that other people are not, or you're attempting, the intent is to make sure that they're not injured or you're preventing injuries, you should, I would think, have to be concerned about being held liable. But these days, those kind of concerns are real. They color the decisions that are made. We don't know what sort of advice to give to people. And it's almost impossible for me to go say, we'll check with your attorney. AGA's members hope that one day they may run their businesses for even one day without having to think of attorneys. I thank you for your time and attention on this most important issue. And again, we urge the passage of HB 58.
Thank you, Frank. Were there questions? Seeing none, we'll go to Kenai next. We have Mr. Leonard Efta and Susan Ross. And then we'll go to Matt Sue. Mr. Efta?
Yes, Leonard Efta from Kenai. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak today. First, I'd like to say that I support the USA representative's opinion from Cordova. I think he pretty much hit the nail on the head. I have a couple of things that bother me with the bill, actually quite a few, but I'll just cover a couple of them. One of them is Section 1, you state that frivolous litigation, according to the statistics and information I have, that they figure about 0.1% of all lawsuits are frivolous. This doesn't look to me like it's a real serious problem. You mentioned in your sponsor statement that 50% goes to the attorneys. I don't see any place in the bill that this is addressed, so it's not going to change. I see no place in the bill for any reduced insurance premiums, so the little guy is not going to benefit from it. I'd like to take a couple statements out of your responses statement here, if I may. It says across the country and throughout Alaska, there is an outcry for reforming our civil justice system. Ordinary people and businesses of all sizes seek relief from the flawed system. I don't think I speak for all the ordinary people, but I do speak to a number of people in the area here, talk to them. Also listen to the radio program. This issue has come up a number of times, and I have yet to hear one of these ordinary people say that they support this tort reform bill. Therefore, I would strongly urge that this thing be filed in 13. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Susan Ross.
Hi. Thanks for the opportunity to address this issue. I feel like this bill is being driven by material representation. That's euphemism for lies. And I say this because approximately 4 years ago, I was approached by a gentleman who was representing a coalition of insurance companies. He approached me because I was active in legal and judicial reform, or an attempt at that process. And he thought I might be interested in lobbying for tort reform. Well, this is a new terminology to me, and I said, well, send me your information about this tort reform. I know nothing about it, and I'll get back to you. So I got the information and read it, and it sounded pretty outrageous to me. It had nothing to do with judicial or legal reform, but it certainly did benefit the insurance coalition, which was soliciting my lobbying efforts. I said, okay, here's the deal. You want me to promote tort reform based on this euphemism that you're going to roll back insurance premiums. I said, I'll go down and lobby for you if you will give me a written guarantee that, in fact, the members of your coalition will guarantee that the insurance premiums will roll back commensurate with the benefits that you derive from this tort reform legislation that you want me to lobby for. Well, that was the end of our discussion. From that point forward, obviously, this man was not in any position and not in any mood to make any guarantees like that. I read the governor's task force report, and quoting from page 7, the task force found no evidence that changes in Alaska law would affect Alaska insurance rates. And yet when I talk to the, quote, common man on the street in length about this tort reform, and I do on a daily basis, that's the battle cry. That's the battle cry of all the small businesses, of even the individuals. Well, we've got to get our insurance rates rolled back. They're out of control. Yet, the euphemism is that this tort reform is going to effectively do that. And that's why I really strongly urge that, for many, many other reasons, that the attorney in Anchorage, prior to my testimony, pointed out there's many, many egregious aspects to this tort reform, but this battle cry that is really nothing more than a lie, which is driving this tort reform process, it's just wrong. It's inherently wrong, and I suggest very strongly that you pay attention to your constituents. They're catching on in pretty large numbers pretty quickly about what this tort reform is all about. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we'll go to Mr. Paul Sweet and Matt Sue, please.
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear?
Yes, go ahead.
Most of all the people that talked so far, I agree with. I think they've come up with some good ideas. Tort reform I believe in, but I was struck by the fact when I first read the transcript of this thing, I was noticing that it seems like now the state is in the business of sitting back waiting for one of its constituents to get maimed or killed so they can share in the profits. I know that's being a little facetious, but the thing is that if anybody's going to profit from it, it should be the victim. And putting the 50% into the general fund means just free trips to, who knows, Colorado, and maybe pay raises for the legislature. I don't really like the idea of approaching the emergency doctors and trying to hurt them to an extent where they are held liable for everything, because they're in a tight situation there where people's lives are involved. They have to make fast and quick decisions. I've also found out that the hospitals now, the state of Alaska does not require full insurance on any of the hospitals. So it would be up to the doctor's word that he had full insurance. If he doesn't, I don't know where the victim would get compensation. I noticed You limit the compensation that could be allowed for death in the family, something like that. And I've always told anybody I knew they were worth $1 million. Now we're putting a limit as to what the value of a human life is. I don't think the state is in a position to be doing that. Let the jury decide. I noticed of the 3,500 suits since the early 1980s, 95% was settled out of court, and you could bet that the insurance companies probably profited from that because they probably paid on the low end of the $100,000, or else they wouldn't have settled. Of the 3,500 cases, 5% went to court. That's 150 cases, and 1 in 20 was awarded punitive damages, so that means 7 cases out of 3,500 was awarded punitive damages. That seems like a heck of a lot of committee meetings and public meetings and God knows what just to get that little end result. So I find him kind of curious as to what else they're trying to hide, because there's not that much in punitive damages, if it has been. Another thing is I guess that's it for me.
Mr. Sweet, if you did have a couple other comments, go ahead with them, please.
All right. Another thing I happen to notice is that I got some of the campaign contributions given to from this elections committee and quite a few of the legislators, and I noticed that 92 or 95% of their campaign contributions came from big business, insurance, oil companies, that kind of thing, and very little from the general public. In fact, they probably couldn't take a cab ride across town on that. But the thing is, I'm wondering where the loyalties are. Is it to the constituency or the big business? That might be a little harsh, but that's the way I feel. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Sweet, I think we did pass a bill last year that is going to cut off contributions from corporations and a number of other entities. So I think we've taken steps to try and address that concern of yours.
Is that the campaign reform?
Yes, it was passed and signed into law last year.
Yeah. The only reason that was passed and signed into law is because it was something that would go on to the ballot. You were kind of forced to do that.
Mr. Chairman, I would also just comment here that trial lawyers who seek to benefit, who will benefit greatly if tort reform does not pass, are also major contributions in election campaigns.
Okay, we'll go back up to Anchorage. We have next Paul Kosman and then Tim Dooley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. This is Paul Kosman in Anchorage. I'm a lawyer. I've worked in several capacities. I've been an insurance defense lawyer, I've been a prosecutor, and I've been plaintiff personal injury. Currently, I do both. I've just recently done a defense case, and I do plaintiff work, too. I'd like to just, if you're taking a nose count, just put on the record that I am opposed to the bill in general. However, I believe that it's likely that a bill is going to come out of the legislature this year and that it's going to be enacted into law. So my goal is to say, let's work on it and make it the best that it can be. I think everybody has that in mind. It's clear in Section 1 of the bill that the goal is to decrease the cost and complexity of litigation. I think that everyone would like to see that done on both sides of the table here. So I'd like to address part of the bill that I think is contrary to that goal. And I'm talking about Section 16, the part that talks about having the jury determine the amount of fault to everybody, whether or not they're involved in the litigation, whether or not they're a party. The way the law is right now, if a plaintiff sues a defendant and the defendant thinks that there's somebody else there to share the